Okay, ready to keep going here. I don't believe most of these don't. You'll see this this particular one is a little difficult to understand. What's this one? But Luigi managed to clear it up here for me. Bubba had no purport at all.
What is their actual position? It's really that he actually says it. I just didn't understand it. There's two different descriptions of the Viragrupa for this particular question. One is they're situated, he says it the same way, are situated in the body, and the other one is that they come from the body. There's two different descriptions.
Yeah, says it twice. A lot of times the editors don't understand these things, you know. They didn't know any Sanskrit at the time. What is that question number? Yeah, here it is. See?
The lokas and their rulers have been described as constituting the bodily parts of the Viragrupa, and as being manifest from those parts. What he wants to know, is there any difference between these two descriptions? Is it the same thing?
You can see it fairly easily in the sense of, even if you don't know the grammar, but the endings on the word switch in the first half and the second half of the verse.
Yeah, that's right. They do.
Avayavaya loka, and then lokaya avayava.
Yeah. So I've heard it both ways, so what's the truth? But the way it ends up here, you see, it says, are situated in, and are supposed to be in. So somehow or other.
This is another one, and make a note of this, you know. I mean, there's a website where you can send in corrections. You got
I think this is where it needs to be corrected. I think there's somehow or other there's some kind of editing mistake.
Yes. The Srinivasa Swami told us that Prabhupada instructed Jayavati that during the Swami, don't edit too much in the second canto. He told us that's the least there.
Well, maybe this is not too much, huh? Changing one preposition from in to from or something.
Why are seeing so many inconsistencies?
Yeah, but he was pretty bewildered when he was going through it. Jayavati tomorrow, the Prabhupada just knew.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to say this about Prabhupada. He was interested in getting things done. And he just didn't really care about spending a whole lot of time making it perfect. He just had, those were his priorities. Just get it out. Prabhupada was always hearing, you know, time's winged chariot. He felt he was an old person. He didn't know how long he would live. That's why in the first canto is so full, because he deliberately tried to make to do as much as he could possibly of Krishna consciousness in the first canto. And I think when he got, I don't know when he started the second canto actually, whether it was before. This looks like a lot. Most of it was written instead of dictated by him, and he just really wanted to get it out. And so his priorities were all. You know, there's two things, there's speed and there's accuracy. And sometimes you can't have both. And when there was a conflict, you chose speed. Later on, we got all the time in the world.
And we notice these little things crop up. And so, that's just the situation.
More competence in those fields now. So,
yeah. So here we go. All these different questions are going on. Here's one I picked up or something. The question is about how people are able to, among other things, by the modes of nature and their karma, Go to the higher planets. This is nice in Sanskrit. Guranam guninam.
The qualities of those who are
in the qualities or under the qualities.
Right, it's like really nice, huh? Gunanam, Guninam. Guninam here is a living being, but what it literally means is those who have the gunas are in the gunas, right? Anyway. So here Prabhupada says, and I just noticed this, life in the higher planets, known as the abodes of the denizens of heaven, is obtained not by the strength of spacecraft, as is now being contemplated by the inexperienced scientists, contemplated because this was before the alleged
moon travel, they're following.
So they're contemplating, but by work done in the mode of goodness. And then he gives this example. This is one reason why Prabhupada says they didn't go to the moon. Even on the very planet where we are now living, there are restrictions upon the entrance of foreigners to countries where the citizens are more prosperous. They're called quotas. For example, the American government has many restrictions for the interest of foreigners from less prosperous countries. The reason is that the Americans do not wish to share their prosperity with any foreigner who has not qualified himself as a citizen of America. This is similarly the same mentality is prevailing in every other planet where there are more intelligent living beings residing. This is called in English keeping out the riffraff. The higher planet, their living conditions are all in the mode of goodness, and anyone desiring to enter the higher planets, like the moon, sun, notice the moon, sun, and Venus, must qualify through activities in complete goodness. That's one reason Prabhupada knows they didn't go to the moon. So here he says it. And when it was claimed, he didn't believe it. I mean, it's a whole controversial topic, but Prabhupada gave in the course of time. Not only was Prabhupada so confident, I have to point out, when the fifth canto came out, and devotees were flipping out, I mean, they were really disturbed in their mind in many cases, because it was so different from our perceptions of the universe. That what Prabhupada did was have in Los Angeles, call a bunch of reporters and announce to them that they didn't go to the moon. Reporters, mind you. Because, according to Bhagavatam, the moon is farther than the sun. And his argument to the reporters was that Monday comes after Sunday. In the orders of the day, the sun is before the moon. The force of Prabhupada's conviction, or whatever, was such that no reporter said, "What does that have to do with it?" You can see it, it's on tape and on folio. But when Prabhupada did that, my intuition was the reason he was doing this, the devotees were so worried that he's willing to sit in front of a bunch of reporters and announce it to them. He's so certain of this thing. The most cynical, skeptical people there are. Anyway, Prabhupada gave three different ways. One hypothesis was that the whole thing was a hoax, a conspiracy, you might call it, which I think maybe is his favorite one. Another one, they didn't go to the moon, but went to Rahu or Ketu. So there was a rocket ship that taped off, but what they describe as the moon is more like a hellish one, which is Rahu or Ketu, the invisible planets that we don't see. They're invisible. They're astrological points, they're called the lunar nodes, astronomical points,
scientists all recognize, but there's posited these two planets, Rahu and Ketu. So they may have gone there by mistake. And of course, the third one is that they went to the moon, but they couldn't enter into the atmosphere of the moon, which sort of does the least amount of damage to maybe your conceived ideas of how things work. So anyway, though he gave different options how it happened, but he used the immigration example. Sometimes people try to sneak into America and get caught, like these boat people from Haiti or Mexico, and they get caught and they get put in some kind of prison camp or something, and then are sent back. So there, you can say that if you're in Florida in some camp for illegal immigrants, you're in America, but not really. It doesn't look like America. That's not Miami. It's camp, huts and no running water and so on.
So if the moon is further, the sun is making.
Well, the interesting thing is that actually, I think, I heard that somebody brought this up to Prabhupada, and he's perfectly aware of it. If you measure straight up from Bhumandala, the moon is further than the sun. If you measure from Bhartvarsha or from Jambudvip, actually the distance the moon is nearer than the sun. The sun is way out there by the Lokaloka Mountains, and the moon is up here, but closer in, somehow or other. Anyway. We don't have to get into all this, but this is an example of.
Like a record disc.
Huh?
I've always heard it explained like a record disc.
Yeah, it is.
The sun's out here.
Yeah, that's right.
The moon's out here, closer
to, yeah, right,
to Earth time, but it's really.
But it depends on what you mean by Earth. Whether you mean Jambudvip or you mean Bhumandala. And I was told somebody, devotees asked Prabhupada about that. He was perfectly aware of it. In other words, he didn't really care. He knows that they didn't go, and then he gives all kinds of whatever reason. Prabhupada was like that. He liked a debate, and he'd use anything to win. Like a professional debater.
Like
Krishna
in the second chapter. He gives all the arguments to Arjuna.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yeah. Whatever, any argument that'll work, use it. That's right. Here again we see in text 16, who wants to know about the inner and outer space of the universe? Got three different things here, three different questions in this particular verse. And again, he uses his expression about Maharaj Pariksit as a typical devotee of the Lord. As such, he's anxious to know the complete significance of the creation, the Lord. He wants to know the inner and outer space of the universal form. It is quite fitting for the real searcher of knowledge to know all about this. Those who are of the opinion that the devotees of the Lord are satisfied with mere sentiments can find in the inquiries of Maharaj Pariksit good lessons as to how inquisitive a pure devotee is to know things in their true perfection. And so, of course, then he asks about the universe, but then about the great souls and so on. Then Prabhupada is talking about varna and ashram. The value of such scientific divisions of human society can be ascertained only in terms of the proportionate development of devotional service to the Lord. He wants to say, right here, this is the really criterion. Is proportionate development of devotional service. Everyone is a government servant, but no one is a government himself.
You should, we can say a little bit about this Varnashram Dharma. is today our tendency is to be anti-hierarchical. The word hierarchy, actually the root meaning of the word hierarchy is from the Greek language, and it means holy or sacred order. Hieros, like hieroglyphics, you know, the holy writing of the Egyptians. So hierarchy. And arche means order. And this is and it's based on the idea ultimately that there's a universal hierarchy, which we see in the Bhagavatam. The God at the top, and then Brahma, and we go down, and when we get the universe, there's Brahmaloka, and there's, you know, the higher planets of Satchaloka, Jnanaloka, Tapaloka, so on. Those where the sages are, and there's the heavenly planets, and there's earth, and there's below the earth. In human society, there's also an order of creation. The animals, what's the king of the beasts?
A lion.
Everybody knows that, right? What's the top of the hierarchy of metals?
Gold,
right? That's because everybody used to believe this. In Europe, everywhere, you know, there was this hierarchy is called the Great Chain of Being, and it was all part of the social system in the West. But in the 18th century, it began to collapse. There's an interesting book by a professor called Lovejoy. Who's one of the early proponents of what's called the history of ideas, who traces this collapse of the great chain of being. It's called the great chain of being, this idea. He traces back to Western antiquity, to the Greeks and so on. But we can see it here also, and used to be just everybody believed it was like this all over the world. But the condition of what we call modern life is the collapse of this chain. And what Lovejoy shows, that the chain, which was up and down, you can say a vertical chain, when it collapsed, it became horizontal. And then to explain that, we had the theory of evolution, which is also based on a kind of chain of being. More animals gradually evolved into higher animals, and we're evolving towards some future perfection. So it became temporalized, simply. Anyway, hierarchy has a bad name. The radical feminists say it's a male concept, but although the chickens have a pecking order, it's called, and that's probably not imposed on them by the roosters. But you know, there's a very anti-hierarchical. So Prabhupada's hierarchical, you know, the Bhagavatam is very hierarchical. And when he says something like first class man, second class, oh, we would say that is elitist. But the real point about what happened is, so long as the chain of being is connected at the top, there's no problem. Because everybody is the servant. See, for example, all of us who become devotees, we accept spiritual master. We accept voluntarily this idea, I have a master. I mean, all of America is based on, you know, I have no master. but we accept a master. And we bow down and so these things like that, do things like that. But for myself, I could see that although Prabhupada was my master, in a sense he was not the master. He's a servant. He's a servant of his spiritual master. And so when a hierarchy is connected, it is clear that everyone is a servant. Everyone's a servant of God. And the person at the top has to be really, and the hierarchy has to be the bigger servant. So as long as that is there, actually there's no problem with hierarchy. In fact, it's natural and it works.
And because on another level, everyone is a spirit soul and everyone is a servant, it's very egalitarian on another way. When God is forgotten, when it becomes disconnected with God, then the whole thing becomes oppressive and it collapses. So this has something to do with the disappearance of the centrality of God. As soon as God is really there and really recognized, naturally this hierarchy, human society will reinstate itself because it's natural. Yeah.
Prabhupada says, best is Brahman, and if you can't be a Brahman, you can't share, if you can't do that, Vaishya. So is this meant for the organization of the society at large, or organization of the preaching institution this coming itself?
Well, people have different ideas about this. He means the society at large. ISKCON itself, he wanted to be primarily a Brahminical institution. I was there in New York, and Prabhupada was asked by reporters, why have you come to the West? And he said, I've come to give you a brain. Prabhupada loved to do stuff to reporters. He had more fun with those people. I've come to give you a break, but he's serious at the same time. And he said, your society is a headless society. And then he explained this head, arms, belly, and legs. And he said, you have no head. I've come to give you a brain. So for that institute, that's his main function, to give a brain. And insofar as ISKCON is a society of Vaishnavas, the Vaishnava is supposed to be at least a Brahmana, more than a Brahmana. Of course, it doesn't really happen. When Prabhupada started talking about introducing Varnashram Dharma, what happened, you see in early parts of the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada said Varnashram Dharma is not possible in this age. It's clear that he changed his mind about it. Because when he was starting to talk about Varnashram Dharma, they said to Prabhupada, who's some GBC people there, it seemed a conversation, we're Vaishnavas, aren't we above that? He says, are you Vaishnavas? He said, then why are they falling down? but anyway, that's it. But ultimately, it's for society at large. The other thing I should point out, in that same conversation, Prabhupada said to the reporters, he said, actually, in your society, everyone is a Shudra, and there are a few Vaishyas. And that, I think that's right on. And what that, aside from the implication of understanding how the world is being run by a handful of people, and people who think they are something else are shudras. I'll tell you what a shudra is. Shudra takes a paycheck. That's right. If you look at Varnashram Dharma, nobody is employed except shudras. Brahmanas, kshatriyas, and vaishyas are economically independent. Brahmanas, by virtue of detachment, and just live on donations. If they don't get donations, they put the grains in the fields or whatever. Kshatriyas, they have some kind of rulership, and they take taxation or whatever else, and whatever their area is. Vaishyas, of course, they are really independent entrepreneurs of one kind or another. They're not employees. As soon as we become an employee, technically speaking, you're a Shudra. So try to live in this world without being an employee. The professors get paychecks. And so on. The military get their paycheck. They're all employees. And if you look and see who's the owners, it turns out to be the same bunch of people. Who the government is really serving, who the universities are really serving, whose interests, you'll find a few vices. I think that's quite true. In fact, it is true. It's can read about in the newspapers. The concentration of wealth into very few hands. Even in America, where everybody seems to be prosperous, actually, some people have. Sometimes the shooters are called debtors, and the vices are called creditors. And you count everybody's debt, you'll see. Anyway, but the other implication, it means that really we have not seen genuine Kshatriyas.
In a long time.
Yeah, well, in our lifetime, and maybe the last lifetime, I would guess of about a couple of 200 years at least. Time. In the army, I have experience. I grew up in the military. My father's a career officer in the United States Army. Anybody who was a real Kshatriya had a hard time. What they wanted was bureaucrats. They ran the army. So anybody with real Kshatriya tendencies usually didn't have great careers. And Brahmins, that's even disappeared. Somebody who's I spent also, you know, my own life for so many years in academics. And these people are for the most part scum. Prabhupada says somewhere in the first canto that a high education and low morals go ill together. Boy, do they. They are not Brahmanas at all.
Bad character.
And all the university students are supposed to be Brahmacharis. Really? And it used to be that way in the Middle Ages. You know, it really was much closer to that. The original universities were, they were all monks. You know? So, anyway, we haven't really, and in Europe, they never were that pure. As long as they were mediators and things like that, they couldn't really understand even that they're not their bodies. They only had glimpses of it. But we haven't really seen these people by our own experience.
What about the existing monarchies in the world?
They're parasites, man. I mean, have you seen any monarchy that actually does it? You either have figureheads, you know, like the Queen of England and so on, who plays with dogs and so on, most of the time.
King of Bhutan, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. And then you have warlords. Real Kshatriyas or something. You can read about them in the Mahabharata. What characters these people are. We see how, you know, have such character. Gandhari, because her husband was blind, she had her eyes bound up, you know. Whoa, these are formidable people. And to us it looks crazy. It's because we're all shooters. Anyway. Yeah.
You know,
yes, it's true. Even in Istra, we're not supposed to charge a fee for teaching. If our gurukulas didn't charge a fee, people would just not bother to pay. You know, the whole social fabric is broken down in so many ways. But you know, it's a gradual process. So. But Prabhupada's notion was, I've come to give you a brain that we can somehow reconstruct society and we start from the head. The other thing Prabhupada wanted was you know, that we should become learned in Srimad Bhagavatam and how to, you know, Jnana Vijnanam Astakyam, we should have
not only book knowledge, but how to apply it, these Brahminical qualities. The other thing we is interested in the self-sufficient forms. Because a lot of this, if you don't have the right vritti, it's very hard for this to manifest within an industrial economy. If one has an agrarian economy, well, then the vaishyas, you know, they'll start to protect cows and become agrarian and not so greed. Their greed will have a natural acquisitiveness that's part of the vaishya spirit, will be moderated, and they'll become pacified by the association with cows, who are really in the mode of goodness. It's true, you spend time with cows. That was the other thing that Prabhupada wanted very much, and it hasn't worked out very well. The only time, you know, real cow protections work is in countries where it's all you've got. The biggest place now for plowing with oxen is Cuba. That's because the United States doesn't allow oil to get into Cuba. As soon as you know, Castro goes or whatever, and or they start letting fuel go in, they're going to eat their oxen and the tractors again.
It's interesting that as soon as the fuel runs out, then the oxen come in.
They'll try some other things yet before that happens. But anyway, this is taking us far afield here in this chapter. Huh? The common religious affiliation here in text 28, what is the universal dharma? There's a dharma that's everybody's essential dharma, and then there's also the dharma, what's sometimes called the swadharma, according to your Prabhupada, called your psychophysical nature. So then Prabhupada says the universal dharma, the common religion of all classes, regardless of whosoever, whatever one may be, is devotional service. Even animals may be included in devotional service to the Lord, which is Hanuman. And then, as we've already discussed, we put the two verses, even the aborigines and camels can be engaged in devotional service. If they happen to be under the guidance of a genuine devotee of the Lord, Yarapastrayasaya. And then he mentions Narada Muni again, and the hunter who became nonviolent. Hunting is not considered to be very advanced. It's Aboriginal means people who live by hunting and gathering, you know, settled agriculture. So the way they live is animal killing. My hunting. So, let's see if I can mark out anything else for these questions. Oh yeah, this is a little, the wording here is a little, can be a little misleading. Tell me also of the advantages and disadvantages of discharging devotional service into the Lord. What he means are, what are the things that are favorable to devotional service and what are the things that are disadvantageous to devotional service. It's not that devotional service has itself disadvantages. Because if you read the purport, he says, sambhavaha, in the sense of perfect means, is employed to denote the discharging of devotional service, and prakti sambhavaha means just the opposite, that which destroys the progress of devotional service. And in this purport, it becomes clear what Prabhupada means by advantages and disadvantages, because he talks about from the nectar of devotion, accepting the things that are favorable and rejecting the things that are unfavorable. You know, the whole list is there. So we should be clear about that. This the advantages and disadvantages. Talking about the advantages, one of them is an honest means of livelihood is listed. The Prabhupada says It is better to become a coolie for an honest livelihood than to become a great man in society by hook and crook.
What's a coolie?
Coolie? A peasant in China. Guys that work in the field, you know, they have those straw hats. People call them coolie hats. That may be where the word came from.
Wow, look it up. Okay, man.
The name was given by Europeans in India and China to a native hired laborer or burden carrier, also used in other countries where these men are employed as cheap laborers. South Africa, an Asian or Indian, especially one of the lower classes.
This is in what? Where are you looking at it?
OED.
Classy OED, okay, you got it.
Yeah.
So does it originally come from India, the word, huh?
Yeah, it's a Gujarati word.
Yeah.
You guys are
narrow
station,
coolies.
Huh?
You
guys
are
narrow station,
taking
luggage.
Yeah. They call them coolies? Okay. Is that the echo you heard? I used to live in Taiwan. Everybody called the guys coolies, the common laborers. I graduated from Taipei American School. This is very nice here about favorable conditions for discharge and devotional service. It should be enthusiastic and determined. If he is not superficially successful in such an attempt, he should not be deterred from the discharge of his duty. Success or failure has no meaning for a pure devotee. Here again, you see this Vishnu Chakravarti. Because he is a soldier in the field. That is, soldiers in the field are supposedly, they do their duty, no matter what. Preaching the cult of devotional service is something like declaring war against materialistic life. So, we are soldiers in the field, the battlefield against Maya. Yeah.
Prabhupada was commenting, he was literally declaring the war against Maya, and then he paused, he said, well, actually Maya is the pure devotee of the Lord, so we are not actually the war against Maya, we declare the war against demons.
Let me see if I picked out anything else. At a certain point I didn't have time to finish marking this. Okay, yeah, this is where he finally, after the questions, he says like this. Huh? Please satisfy my inquisitiveness from the beginning of my questions. Please give me full knowledge in this connection. Huh? And Prabhupada says the spiritual master is always prepared. And specifically the disciple is very inquisitive. So again, Maharaj Prithinaras, he keeps using this phrase, typical disciple. Not typical in the sense of average, as we often use it in English here, but like kind of like a model, a type, another sense of the word type, or prototype, you would say. Yeah, this is interesting to point out. Now he says to you are as good as Brahma, the original living being, Parameshti. Others follow custom only. Anutishtanti purvesham, as a matter of purvija, previous knowledge, as followed by previous philosophical speculators. Do you recognize these speculators? What he's talking about? Gautama, Kanada, Jaimini, Kapila, Astabhatra, and also Pantanjali?
You know who these are?
I know it's the Aeneas Capilla. I know
that. It is the Aeneas Capilla, but this list. Huh? Yeah, they're called the Sub-Darshan. You want to write that on the board? The six darshans. And these are lists. When you read these things in a university course in Hinduism, they call them orthodox. But by orthodox, they mean astik. And here's another word. You know this word? Astika. That's an important word. One of the characteristics of a Brahmana is astikyam. The Prabhupada calls it theism or theistic or something like that. But what it really, asti means it is. It's a word of assent. And it means accept the authority of the Vedas. So those philosophers who accept the authority of the Vedas are called Astika. Those who do not are called Nastika. This is like Buddhists and Jainists, who although they come out of the Vedic tradition, they don't accept the authority of the Vedas. So these six darshans, all of these philosophers accept the authority of the Vedas. Nevertheless, they are here described as not really with it, because they come to different schools. The Gautama is the sage who is the authority of is Gautama Nyaya?
Yeah.
The school of thought that's called Nyaya. N-Y-N-A-Y-A, Nyaya. Nyaya is usually translated as logic. And in this very place, Mayapur, was a big center of Nyaya philosophy, and so many of them left to become followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was a big professor of a branch of Nyaya called Navanyaya, Neo-Nyaya. You can still, his books are in the University of Pennsylvania Library. Before he became a devotee, this is logic books. But remember, he said, I was like a dry stick, and then you made me blossom. So that this is the called Nyaya. But Prabhupada gives many Nyaya examples. We still use things from Nyaya, a lot of things from Nyaya. Next is Kannada. And you know, anybody know what that one is? What is it called in Sanskrit? I forgot. Vaisheshika, yeah. Atom, it has to deal with atoms, the theory of atoms and so on. Vaisheshika. What does it mean?
Well, because each atom is distinct from the other, so each atom has a vaisheshika from each other atom. They're pluralists.
Yeah, they're pluralists, right?
The atom.
So this is their acharya is Kannada. Gautama Kannada Jaimini, the sage Jaimini.
We're going to do this in order, though. Should we skip?
I'm just going to order of what? Do you chronological?
Well,
parallel. Huh?
Shouldn't we parallel?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, okay. That's getting technical for this crowd, but usually they're paired together. Like Nyaya is a philosophy of logic and thinking. Whereas Vaisheshika is a kind of ontological theory about what's concrete in the world. And so they usually go together. The Nyaya philosophers accept the Vaisheshika view of the world, which, by the way, is theistic. They accept God in that sense.
But as the efficient, not material cause.
Yeah, just as the efficient cause of the world. Anyway, so... Okay, so then what do you want to do next together?
Okay, Kapila. Kapila. This is the atheistic Kapila. And then we should know what his, that's called, huh?
Sankhya.
Sankhya, right. Sankhya. Again, a theory of what's in the world, but this accepts two categories, Purusha, which is what we would call the jivas, and property. Purusha and property. And deals with the liberation of the Purushas and from property. And by the ultimate goal is the individual Purushas become isolated. There's no society of them, there's no supreme Purusha, neither do they associate with each other. They just go into isolation. And that property stops acting upon them. That's the Sankhya, atheistic Sankhya.
Sounds lonely.
Huh?
Sounds lonely.
They don't mind. They don't like other people. Huh?
It's hard to see where the acceptance of the Vedas is, especially the last concept.
Well, they base it on Shrutayo-Vidina. There's a statement about the Vedas that they exist in different divisions. So you can pick and choose. Other thing that is kind of associated with Sankhya is Pantanjali. And this is yoga. And the yoga is a series of techniques, mostly, and so on. But although Pantanjali, actually in the Yoga Sutra, Ishvara Pranida is there in the beginning and also in the perfectional stage, that is, surrender to the Lord is in there. But this is a controversial point with some people, how important Ishvara is in the Pantanjali Yoga Sutra. But generally, their other part of their worldview is Sankhya. Much of what's in the Bhagavatam is overlaps with Sankhya, as even taught by Kapila. And we also have things from yoga. I mean, all of these. The next one is Jaimini. Yeah, Karma Mimamsa, correct. A truck driver knows. Not really a street driver. The only truck driver in America, probably.
you got two
truck drivers. Just as sometimes the Lord incarnates his animal species to save the animals, so also we appear among the truck drivers, degraded demons. Yeah, karma mamamsa. You know what karma mamamsa is? In fact, I mentioned it already.
Yeah, karma is supreme.
Karma is supreme.
If there is a God. He's subjected to karma.
By karma, they really mean, strictly speaking, the ritual actions of sacrifice. These are the technicians of sacrifice. If they take that karma kanda portion of the Vedas and say, this is all that there is. These are the ones that Krishna is talking about in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, the Veda Vada Rataha. They are very fond of the words of the Vedas, but they don't understand the purpose. So these are the fruits of workers who are only interested in going to the heavenly planets and form sacrifice of Boga and Aishwarya. That's Jaimini is the main one of the philosophers of Karma Mamamsa. Nevertheless, everybody accepts from the Karma Mamamsa they develop the principles for understanding scripture. What are known as hermeneutical principles, and that which almost everybody follows. Even though they don't accept the karma mamamsa. And sort of associated with that, if only to
is what he puts down here is astavakra. No, that's this is astavakra. Usually the main philosopher for this next school is called Vyasa. But Prabhupada, because we're so here appreciating Vyasadeva so much, Prabhupada puts astavakra, because this is called two ways, Vedanta or Uttara Mamamsa. Karma Mamamsa is also called Purva Mamamsa. What is the meaning of Mamamsa?
Examination,
right. So Purva means the previous and Uttara means the later. Mamamsa. So they're both called Mamamsa. Huh? Brahma Mamamsa sometimes, right? Now, the Vedanta, in many cases, or the most prominent cases, today people think Vedanta means you're an impersonalist. Or it's focused on Brahmavadis or Mayavadis. But of course we have our Vaishnava Vedanta. It was like news to a lot of people in the West that there was such a thing as a theistic Vedanta. But, you know, Madhvacharya is a Vedantist, Ramanujacharya is a Vedantist, Balabhadra Vibhushana is a Vedantist. So we have a theistic Vedanta. But when he mentions Astavakra, he means those who are pursuing this Vedanta or Uttara Mamamsa with a view to the impersonal view. So all of these follow custom only. They are not, in other words, they are not as good as Brahma, the original living being. And we have Vyas in this side, not on that side. So that's why I saw this Astavakra. Their story, Astavakra is crippled in body, and it's Astavakra means crooked in eight places. There's some story about some girls were laughing at him because it was so funny. First thing or somebody, I don't remember exactly. So actually, we should have some knowledge of this. There's a, what's that textbook? Chatterjee, and you can get it here in Bengal. Prabhupada recommended it actually. He used it. It's a outline of Indian philosophy by Chatterjee and Dutta. It was published in Calcutta, and it was a textbook, I guess, that Prabhubhad used. He recommended it.
In the Bhakti Vedanta course, which comes after Bhakti Vedanta course, there will be a...
Okay, well, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but... Well, these are the Shad Darshans. So what it's saying here is that we're actually what this is being presented in Bhagavatam is not among them. Because these are considered speculative, ascending process, but Prabhupada says all these six great rishis have their own ways of thinking, exactly like the modern philosophers of mental speculations. They try to base it on the Vedas, but they go off in so many directions. From our point of view, this is why Krishna came and spoke Bhagavad Gita, because it's really hard to figure out what is the conclusion, what's the Siddhanta. Everyone believes that the Vedas somehow form a single harmonious conclusion, a Siddhanta. But the experts say different things. So that's why one reason Krishna comes and speaks the Bhagavad Gita is just to say, okay, this is what it is. This is the conclusion. Vedaishta sarva aham eva Veda. By all the Vedas. All the Vedas are just searching after me.
That's the continuum. Okay.
So, is there a reason why Prabhupada doesn't mention Patanjali immediately when she mentions the other five first?
I don't know. He just said he mentioned, he turns around and says Patanjali is also one of them. I don't know.
So Prabhupada's explaining that Sukadeva Goswami's authority here is that he's coming through Ramana directly from the personality of Bhagavad.
Yeah, that's right.
The other side
presents the knowledge which comes directly, down directly from Brahmaji, who is known as Atmabhu, that's in the verse. Or born, it was born, or educated by the Almighty Personality of God. He pulls that out of Atmabhu.
If the other systems, if they're based on the Vedas, the Vedas are enunciated from the personality of Godhead, so don't they have the same claim in direction?
Yeah, they may, but you have to know what to conclude. The Vedas we know from the beginning of Bhagavatam is a desire tree. You can get any fruit you want. So because it has so many things for so many people, that they can, or you can base many, many things on the Vedas. But that's why you have to understand the meaning behind it. The second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is dedicated to clearing up some of this stuff. And you'll notice what the Bhagavad Gita does is Krishna takes on so many different paths that are enunciated in the Vedas. The question is, what is Dharma that is really comes up at the Dharma Kshetra? What am I supposed to do? And he takes it out all the way. So in the Vedas there are many different things that people practice in the name of the Vedas. And there's some justification for it. But what Krishna shows, if you look at them one by one, whether it's sacrifice, or worship of the devatas, or yoga, or a dhyana, if you understand it thoroughly in its depth, or you follow it all the way out to the end, it comes to devotional service. Therefore, he can recommend at the end, sarva dharman pujaja mame kam saranam bhaja. You don't have to go through all this stuff, you can come to me directly for shelter. Mame kam, me and no one else, or nothing else. That's this, what he does.
Probably do a study of Bhagavad Gita as it is, analyzing how all these philosophies are resolved.
Jaimini, the Astavakra, Pantanjali, the first three, Sankhya, but then he discusses other things that are not really in there. More things, just the nature of sacrifice in general, not just specifically the rituals, but other kinds of sacrifice, what they mean, the worship of the various devas, that's also in the Bhagavad Gita rather prominently, which is not really so much a part of any of these, as far as I know.
Not Kama Mimamsa.
No, they don't like the Devas. They think the Devas got to do what they do. If they do anything at all, they have to.
But he discusses in the second chapter.
What?
Kama Mimamsa gives the arguments. Krishna from Kama Mimamsa.
Where?
You just fight and then.
Oh, yeah.
Heavenly planets or material enjoyment.
Yeah. Otherwise, you'll be. You'll
just by fighting, you get that momentum. Just by doing it.
But the common masses, they're into sacrifices.
Yeah.
But not to the devas.
Well, the devas, when you do a sacrifice, you have to talk about the devas and say mantras to the devas and everything like that. But the Karma Mimamsas say that it's actually the correct pronunciation of the mantras and the procedures of the sacrifice that gives the results, not the devas.
If the
devas are involved at all, they just have to obey. That means the priests are the ones with the real power. Yeah. Prabhupada calls it later on these mental speculations, he calls them hackneyed ways of thinking. One will lose tired, become tired. Well, let's just quickly review the end of this chapter. I don't think I was able to come here and make any. He uses these names, Brahmarata and Vishnurata. Sukadeva Goswami is Brahmarata, and in the text, and Balaj. Sukadeva Goswami. Well, see, now we're back to Sukha Goswami. See, now we're in Nainisharanya Forest. That's the sort of outer frame of the narration. So now Sutta is talking. So it says, now he narrates, the Sukadeva Goswami being invited by Maharaj Pariksit to speak on topics of the of Lord Sri Krishna with the devotees was very much pleased. So they use his name Brahmarata, and the Prabhupada is protected by Vishnu. So he began to reply by saying, Praha, he said, this Bhagavatam, this Puranam of the name of Bhagavatam, this Puranam, Brahma Samhitam, was spoken first by the Lord Himself to Brahma when he was first born. So now we're getting ready for this origin of the Bhagavatam. When Brahma was first born, and he calls a Vedic supplement. Bhagavatam spoken by the Lord, I guess Brahma Samhitam, unto spoken by Bhagavat Prokta in the Brahma Kalpa. And then the first creation, the first day of Brahma is called the Brahma Kalpa. He also prepared himself to reply to all that King Purikit had inquired from him. Maharaj Pariksit was the best in the dynasty of the Pandus, and thus he was able to ask the right questions from the right person. Yeah, so that winds it up.
The right question.
Yeah.
This Bhagavatam from the very beginning was spoken by Sri Krishna for many narrators. So what is the actual Bhagavatam? You know, because we have Bhagavatam. Is this Bhagavatam written by Vyasadeva starts with the first chapter, and then he himself describes the life that was given to him, and it was also spoken like this to Maharaj Pariksit from the very first shloka, or how it is. So many.
You have to answer that question?
According to Jiva Goswami's commentary,
Jiva Goswami says,
at the beginning of the second canto, what Shukadeva speaks is the entire Bhagavatam from the beginning of the first canto to the end of the 12th. Yeah. That the whole thing, and there's all these questions about, you know, which happened first and how much of it could have been revealed by them, but he basically said that the previous verse also comes up. He says it's Brahma Samhita, means that it's equal to the Vedas. that it's actually Shruti, it's not Kavrusha, it's co-eternal with Krishna.
Yeah, that's one implication of that word, right?
Yeah. And so that it was from before any of these actual events took place where it was narrated, the whole thing existed in its complete form. And so the entire thing in its complete form was, at least in that presentation, the primary recitation between Shukha and Briksha, the entire thing being recited. Although some of it is the background to that narration, that background also got recited at that narration.
Yeah.
I asked Gopi Pranada in the Prabhu how that worked. And don't ask me that.
Yeah, that's the authoritative answer. Anything else?
Well, you just mentioned also in text 10 of the first chapter in the second prophet says that all 18,000 verses were spoken by Vyasadeva Sukadeva.
By?
Vyasadeva Sukadeva Goswami.
Yeah, he does say that. It's true.
Although there is references in the seventh chapter, there's reference, he uses two words in a row in one verse of the seventh chapter of the first canto, which our acharyas have taken as indicating that the Bhagavatam was first revealed into the mind of Vyasadeva in seed form. And that seed form corresponds to the Chatushloki Bhagavatam. And he then, on the basis of that, he compiled the Vedanta Sutras. And then later, realizing that wasn't enough, the rest of the seed came out in its full form, and he revealed the rest of the Bhagavatam.
The example of the seed is very interesting because it sometimes shows that, like a seed, is very small and compact, but inside is the whole plant. So in the beginning, you may not see the whole thing. Yeah, Prabhupada planted seeds. You know, you will not see what he has done until some time passes when it has time to grow. Yeah, which is interesting. The idea of the seed form. It's all there, but it's just not all manifest. Yeah?
I have a question about a topic that we discussed earlier today in text number one.
Text number one?
Yeah, text number one. Where you focused on this statement where that the test for a bona fide spiritual master is that there should be no difference between the instruction of the Lord originally imparted to his devotee and that which is imparted by the authority in the line of specific succession.
Yeah, that's what he says.
Yeah. So it's talking about a test. So in other words, that there's no difference between the original instruction and that which is the coming to the parampara.
Mm-hmm.
So, even in the short time that, you know, where, like, for example, our institution has been established, you know, there's been a lot of different kind of conceptions and ideas and activities and all based on Prabhupada's statements, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, claiming to be, we could say, no difference between the instruction. Mm-hmm. But even in a short time, we can see there's a lot of kind of different things coming up, seemingly based on the same instruction.
Well, you may notice that, there's been our history. There's been offshoots and branches, and some of them are considered to be useless, and so on. So this will happen. One thing is, sometimes Prabhupada says there's transcendental disagreement. Transcendental agreement is about application. Let's serve Krishna this way, let's serve Krishna that way. So when it comes to applying Krishna consciousness in concrete and particular circumstances, there may be transcendental disagreement. That's a question of application. And You know, that, how do we deal with that? Well, we have a system. We're supposed to discuss it, talk about it. And really, if you look how Prabhupada set up the ISKCON, you know, there's a group of people that's supposed to come to a conclusion. That's the GBC, if it comes up that far, about what's okay and what's not okay. This is the application of the principles to time and place and circumstance. This is part of the jnana, the practical application of knowledge. So one needs to have good judgment and the guidance of God on this matter. And we should know how to be such people that we have good judgment and we receive the guidance of Krishna. And Prabhupada gave us plenty of instructions how to do that, the principles by which we are able to apply this stuff, actually. But sometimes, there could be, it's not that one side is really wrong and the other side is really right, but it's just a matter of practice. When there's more substantial things, then we have to look that people are going off in the wrong direction. How do we know which one is right? Well, better get to know what Prabhupada said and what the Bhagavatam says.
Can you give some example of what is tolerable and what is not really?
Nothing comes to mind right now. 6:30 at night after a long day. I'm sorry? Yeah, he mentions Prabhupada, mentions Astavakra as the representative of Vedanta.
Mm-hmm.
How Vasudev? Well, actually, before Vasudev, Vasudev is called the Sutrakar. Vyasadeva is called Sutrakara. He compiled the Vedanta Sutra. But there were other compilers of Vedanta Sutras also. He wasn't the only one. Now he's the one that's prominent. But there were others before him and also after him.
So then, Astavakra philosophy and Vyasadeva philosophy are the same?
They're not the same. No, they're two different people. Two different sages.
So why is he saying Vyasadeva here?
Why are you saying Vyasadeva? He doesn't say Vyasadeva. He says Astavakra.
No, Astavakra is the Vyasadeva.
Why I said Vyasadeva?
Why did I write
Vyasadeva? Oh, why did you write Vyasadeva?
Because they both teach something which is called
Vedanta. Just to say that usually, when you will see the six darshan mentioned, they will say as the sage for Vedanta, they will say Vyas. People say that.
Vastavaka also say that when you're saying about Vedanta, Vyasada also saying about Vedanta.
Well, one was doing a disciplic succession and the other one was basically.
In
other words, there is a Vedanta, as we all know, that does not lead to what Brahma is teaching and what Krishna is teaching. There's another Vedanta. And there also, it is very clear. Mahaprabhu, when he was in Banaras, he shows very clearly that Shankaracharya misrepresents Vyasadeva. Not only that, but there's an interesting occurrence if you're interested in it. You know, there's in the late 19th century and early 20th century, there was the, what is that series called? The Great Books of the Orient or something?
Sacred Books of the East?
Sacred Books of the East, yeah, the series.
Oh,
So they were translated by various people who were translating, the Manusamhita and all these things. What was the guy who, who sponsored this, the great in,
Mueller was the
yeah, Max Mueller, Max, the German Max Mueller, did the sacred books of the East, and they did all these translations into European languages, English actually, about this. So they did also this George Thibaud translated first the Shariraka Bhasha of Shankaracharya. Then he translated also in the same series the Sri Bhasha of Ramanujacharya. So when he published that, he remarked in his introduction that he, as far as he could see, he was very surprised to find out that it was very clear that Ramanuja was actually was closer to the original meaning of the sutras than Shankaracharya. And he remarked that Ramanuja was actually, in a sense, a better commentator as far as what the chakras, the sutras originally said. This was his judgment as the translator of both, and as a pretty competent philosophical mind. Then he received so much protest from Indian pundits, because then he wrote the second edition, he had a big response to this. He said, I received so much mail from India protesting my statement. But he said, almost all these letters of protest I got were philosophical.
He was thrown off from India.
Huh?
He was thrown off from India.
Max Mueller was. Was he really?
Thibaud.
He was that in his book, and so many books.
Of Max Mueller?
Yes,
oh, and this is there. We're talking about the person who translated. Maybe the reason was Thibaud. I don't know why they seized them. You know why? What did they say? That's interesting. I didn't know that. Anyway, he says that these arguments in defense of Shankaracharya were philosophical. But he's not. But Thibaud said, my point is not philosophical. It's exegetical. It has to do with what the actual text says. But you know, and if you actually follow the text, you will see that Ramanujacharya is the better exegete in explaining the text of the sutras. And he goes into a long defense of that, which is very interesting. And Mahaprabhu says, according to the statement of Chaitanya Charitamrita, when Mahaprabhu finally presented Vedanta Sutra, it says very interesting. It says that the sannyasi said that you have made Vedanta Sutra self-evident. It was self-evident. What you say is self-evident. And when they saw it presented from a theistic background, suddenly there it was. You just couldn't argue with it. Self-evident. And I would say that there's two signs of self-evidence. This is in mathematics, for example. What you look for is two things in a proof. That it is sound and that is complete. Sound means free from internal contradiction or conflict. So that was clear. When you put the sutras together in this way, it was sound and it was complete. It didn't leave anything out. We don't look at the sutra very carefully. It was complete. And the third thing I want to add to this is that it was elegant. And elegance mathematics is the term that you put everything together, or you get from the start to the beginning in the fewest number of steps. It's simple. And when you see those things together, it's sound, it's complete, and it's simple, you just say, that's it. But this is my understanding of this. And then you just can't argue with it once you see it. And then if you start to look, if you've got an idea, then you start to look at Shankaracharya, how he does it. It's like somebody, one of these things when you try to scratch your nose this way instead of like this. I mean, he's just torturing the text to get his meaning out of it. It's really true. Vyasadeva is actually a theist when he wrote Vedanta Sutra. But then so many other people have tried to eliminate theism from it. It's just a fact. And even somebody like Thibault, who just didn't, as we say, have a dog in this fight, you know, he didn't have an interest, he wasn't cared one way or another, but was pretty competent. He could see very easy that Ramanuja was actually by far the better understanding of the Vedanta Sutra.
As what did you say, Dhammaratta Pari?
Huh?
Dhammaratta and Vishnuratta.
What about?
Alps. What is the definition of Dhammaratta?
Brahmaratta?
Huh?
Yeah. What's the literal meaning of Ratta, like in Vedavada Ratta? Affectionate to, or protected by, or ever, you know? You can say lover of Brahma, in this case Brahman, you know, of the absolute truth, and Vishnu Ratta. Prabhupada calls protected by Vishnu.
Vishnu Ratta
is Prakshamaras. Yeah, it's Prakshamaras.
Because it's Brahma.
Yeah, that's right, that's what it says. That's the name.
It's not Brahma, it's more Brahma. Brahma is. There's no longer
Brahma. Yeah, Brahma. Yeah,
right.
Huh?
He was saying it's not Lord Brahma because there's no long A, but it wouldn't be anyway.
Anyway.
Compound, but it's not.
But it's not Lord Brahma. Yeah.
From context, you understand.
Let's get that
answer. All right. Okay. Thank you very much. Tomorrow's a liberty holiday. Holiday, the original meaning of holiday is holy day, right? So that's what it is. It's the appearance of a Dvaita Charya. So we don't have class tomorrow. Right? No class tomorrow.
Day after tomorrow?
Day after tomorrow, we keep going. Yeah.